All right, the December 11th, 2013 College of DuPage Special Board of Trustees meeting is called to order. Will the secretary please call the roll?
Student trustee Torres?
Present.
Trustee Hamilton?
Yes.
Trustee McGuire?
Here.
Trustee O'Donnell here. Trustee Savage?
Here.
Trustee Svoboda?
Here.
Trustee Wozniak?
Here.
Chairman Burt?
Here. I will entertain a motion to approve tonight's special board meeting agenda.
So moved.
So moved by trustee McGuire. Is that seconded by trustee?
Yeah.
Oh, Secretary O'Donnell? Thank you. Can you please, or not you, but Secretary O'Donnell, can you call for a voice vote, please?
All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
The agenda motion passes. I have been informed that for the public comment section that there are no names on the list. I see that nobody is present, but maybe for the record, I should just say that if there is anybody here that needs to make or that would like to address the board, they have the time to do so. Seeing none, we will then move on to the next portion of the agenda, which is the closed session. And at this time, the board will go into closed session for the purpose of discussing self-evaluation, practices and procedures, or professional ethics when meeting with a representative of a statewide association of which the public body is a member. Do we need to move and second that? Okay, I think I heard Trustee Savage moved that. Was there a second?
Yes.
Or Trustee McGuire seconded that. Secretary O'Donnell, can you please call the roll?
Student Trustee Torres?
Yes.
Trustee Wozniak?
Yes.
Trustee Hamilton?
Yes.
Trustee McGuire?
Yes.
Trustee O'Donnell, yes. Trustee Savage?
Yes.
Trustee Svoboda?
Yes.
Chairman Burt?
Yes. All right, at this time the board will go back into open session. It is approximately 8:37. Will the secretary please call the roll?
Student Trustee Torres?
Yes.
Trustee Hamilton?
Yes.
Trustee McGuire?
Yes.
Trustee O'Donnell here. Trustee Savage?
Here.
Trustee Svoboda?
Here.
Trustee Wozniak?
Here.
Chairman Burt?
Present. We are moving on to presentations or various topics. The first one is the bidding protocol. We have Ken Florey and Russ Vasquez here to discuss the bidding protocol.
Thank you.
Good evening. I passed out a handout that I've prepared from when I typically lecture to the community colleges, whether it's at our college administrator conference or ICTA. I think many of you have heard me speak on many topics, and bidding is one of the topics that I speak on quite often. So that's what I've handed out. It starts off with the copy of the bidding statute and gets into the detail that we deal with on a day-in and day-out basis, dealing with bidding, when it's required, challenges. As you see, the more you get into it, the more you'll understand how complex it can get with the public bidding statutes, because the rules are, the best way I like to describe them, it's like a board game. It doesn't always follow logic. It's what the General Assembly decided to put out there for what you have to publicly bid and what you don't have to publicly bid. So it's really learning the rules, and oftentimes our advice, people will ask, well, can you show me in a statute where that describes what you just told me, or show me the case? And the most common response is we handle bidding lawsuits every year. There are a handful of bidding lawsuits, but a lot of it is predicting what would happen with a challenge. And the attorneys that work with bidding issues in my firm are always amazed that every month we get a new bidding question that we haven't heard before, and different permutations and different variations. So, and I'm sure Rez is the same way. It's incredible how many different variations there are out there. And you look at the problem and say, well, I believe this is how a court would rule based on our experience with handling these types of lawsuits. So it's an interesting area, but a complex area. I'm going to just briefly talk about some of the public policy behind the bidding. And then Rez is going to jump in, and then we're going to hear from Tom about what you guys actually on the administrative level are doing with your bidding. Public bidding in the low bidder, it's a love-hate concept. I mean, the public bidding, the policy behind it is for both the colleges to get the best price for your public dollars. That's the concept with a low bidder. From the vendor perspective, it's to participate in the expenditure of public dollars. So vendors have as much of a right and a legal interest in bidding contracts as the college does and the taxpayers do in getting the best bang for your dollar. So, but the bidding laws have evolved because the low bidding concept is not always a good thing. The bidding statute and the cases have tried to weed out the bad contractors, but oftentimes it's such a cutthroat environment that the low bidders will really cut their bid to such a low point that it affects quality, it affects workmanship. There are companies that will simply be brokers. They'll put in a low bid, totally lowball the number, get the contract, and then they go shop out other subcontractors to do the work. They didn't do any work. They simply get the bid bond, get the bid, and then find out how to do it afterwards. Half of my work is litigation involving bidding issues and construction defects because of the low bidder concept. Because you try to knock out a contractor who's questionable, but it's very difficult to do. If they're the low number, and if they've provided everything in their bid packet that they're supposed to, that you've asked for, you have to accept them unless they've got specific instances of bad conduct. Litigation, adverse lawsuits, direct delays or penalties, liquidated damages assessed against the contractor from the institution. So it's very hard to really find the bad contractors, because the bad contractors, what they will do, there's a famous road contractor who actually was defrauding local governments. Some of the owners went to jail, and so the next generation simply opened a new company under a different name with the same equipment, same employees, and now they can bid. So they learn how to get around it. So the low bidding concept, it's important because it does ensure that you're getting the best bang for your buck with public dollars, and obviously that's a primary concern. And hopefully you're getting a contractor that's qualified to do that. The administration at the college prepares meticulous specifications so that you ensure that you are getting contractors who know what they're doing. And your litigation in general of construction defects is lower than the average bear, which means you've got a lot of good systems in place. You have good construction managers and good architects that do a very good job at keeping an eye on these bidders to make sure that they're doing, getting you the best product possible. The bidding process you follow with construction, where you bid out different trades, also ensures that you're getting contractors who are best qualified and truly are capable of doing the work as you're asking them to do, along with getting the low price. But there are a list, as you see on the first page, a list of exceptions to bidding. And some of them make sense and some of them really don't make any sense. Computers. Some of these are outdated. The computer bidding exception, you don't have to go to public bid if you're buying any type of computer equipment, printers, cables, copiers. And these type of exceptions were created when there was only IBM and that was it. You didn't want to buy a computer that someone built out of their garage. Now that computing company became Dell Computers, and now you can buy computers at Best Buy so that bidding exception kind of has lost its value, but it's still in there. And there are some of these other exceptions that don't necessarily make sense. There are other exceptions that make great sense. Professionals, you don't want to pick the low bid architect, the low bid construction manager, the low bid auditor or accountant or attorney. So obviously, the low bid artist. You don't want to hire someone to do artwork because they're giving you the lowest price. So the professional exception is another one of those that really makes a lot of sense, and I'll let Rez talk about some of the other exceptions. But getting past the decision of when you have to bid or not is fairly complex, and that's where we get the questions on a monthly basis. Do I have to bid this? Here's a scenario. But then the rest of my handout talks about once you've made the decision to publicly bid it and you actually go to public bid, the 101 things that could go wrong in the bidding process that results in all the litigation, whether it's the low bid, and it's typically a low bidder who's you're trying to knock them out by saying you're not qualified, you have a bad reputation, and there's a lot of litigation over can you knock me out. So you end up spending a lot of legal fees trying to knock out a low bidder because you've gotten stuck with this low bidder, and they've followed the rules just enough to qualify, but that's it. And after that, it's a risk that you may or may not be willing to take. Withdrawing bids, modifying bids, the whole ins and outs of public opening of bids and fax bids and delays in delivery and what does lowest mean? You think that's simple, but it's not. So if you can't sleep at night, pull this out and start reading about what a responsive and non-responsive bid is, and you'll be out like that. But it gets pretty complex, and that's a part of the good and the bad about public bidding. It's good for lawyers, but not always good for the local governments, because it results in a lot of litigation. And once you've made a decision, okay, it doesn't have to be publicly bid, some institutions then say, they go to a vendor and they say, you're our vendor and we're going to give it, here's the contract. Most institutions, such as the college, just because it doesn't have to be publicly bid doesn't mean you still don't have a competitive process, which means getting quotes, requests for proposals. So you're following this, you're taking the good and not the bad, which means it's competitive. There's a fair dealings with other vendors. All the vendors can participate in your contract selection. You're making sure you're getting a good price because you have several quotes, several proposals, but you don't have to accept the lowest one. You have the luxury of choosing among the people who've submitted a proposal and looking into some of the items that you couldn't get away with if you just had to go with a low bid process. So that's the experience we've had in working with the college for over 20 years, is that you don't just take a shortcut just because it doesn't have to be publicly bid. You do public selection process, you get several quotes so that you're protecting the tax dollars, but at the same time making sure you get the highest quality contractor. And that's, if legislation is going to go anywhere over the years, it's going to be more towards a request for proposal process that you follow, where you give the college and other local governments discretion to select a contractor, not just on the low price, because the low price oftentimes is good for lawyers and bad, like I said, bad for local governments, good for lawyers. So I'll leave it at that, and Russ, if you want to jump in.
I can add some other things. In terms of, as Ken mentioned, regarding it, whatever requirements or contracts you need to bid that are above $25,000, the issue is you award it to the lowest responsible bidder. So it's not, you're not stuck with the actual low price. What you do is look at which is the low price with the responsible vendor and bidder. So there's an opportunity in which, under the bid specs that you do release, you define what the responsibility is in terms of, you know, your experience with, and I've seen this with the college too, in terms of laying out the type of experience, qualification of vendors, their satisfaction history, any potential litigation that's out there to determine what a bidder in terms of what responsibility is. And in addition to that, there are other notice requirements in terms of posting, advertising, when the bid opening is going to be, and giving an opportunity for people in terms of there's a 10-day requirement letting them know when the bid opens, but also then a 3-day requirement of publication in which you give them the date and time of where the bid's going to open. It's a very formal process when you get the sealed bids and open and announcing, and that's sometimes entertaining in terms of bidders being able to bring their sealed bids, I've had questions where they're like 10 seconds late, and it was not accepted, and is that a material change or not? A dream world for lawyers, and so the formal process is a requirement that there is a cost. So although the spirit is to try to get the best buck for your dollar, the problem is that sometimes the competitive bidding process also involves these what I call indirect effects of litigation and disputes that may end up not saving you as much. So the only reason why I say that is, as Ken mentioned, the exceptions that are listed, some of them are outdated, some of them maybe do not make sense, but I always advise clients, take them, because then you have the flexibility of not adhering to the competitive bidding process as outlined in the statute, but you can set some type of RFP process or some other forms of quotations like what Ken sort of suggested, but some of informal process in which you can follow. There have been, in my experience, we've had challenges such as in particularly in the natural gas utility, where we've actually had litigation not here, but for other clients that we represented, in which the vendors were arguing that this exception no longer applies because now there is other utilities that are willing to offer quotes, et cetera, that may offer that. We still fought against in court to be able to defend that, and the judge ultimately agreed that it's the General Assembly who makes the decisions in terms of whether it should be bid or not, just because I think it's just best for you or our clients to have the flexibility not to bid, and unless they want to. Some of the examples that are out there, for example, the high degree of professional skill, contracts with services of individuals who have a high degree of professional skill that usually, obviously, not that Ken and I would like to promote ourselves, but it does involve your legal services, but auditing services also that used to, in my day, architects, engineers, but then they came up with the Local Professional Selections Act that now deals with a hybrid form of a bidding process, so to speak, in terms of you first, with architects and engineers, you first have to look at their qualifications, you rank them based on that. The highest firm that is that you find more qualified, you negotiate a price with that individual. I'm assuming the architects and engineer lobbyists are the one who entered that negotiation, because I find it something odd, because if the most qualified, you may not end up with the lowest price based on, but you're forced to deal with them and the highest ranking qualified company. Other contracts such as printing of finance committee reports, department reports, contracts for the engraving of bonds, tax warrants, other evidence of indebtedness, contracts for the purchase, delivery, movement, installation as computers, software, hardware, that's been up for litigation at one point in time, too, where we had a case in which they were trying to argue that is now biddable in terms of, or should be biddable because the market has changed on that. We were successful and able to kick that out as well. Duplicating machines, which are the old Xerox copier machine supplies, that's still an exception. Equipment owned by some other entity other than the districts are sort of secondhand used equipment. Also equipment owned by another government entity. If you're procuring or purchasing goods or services from another government entity, you don't have to bid that. I know the college has participated in some consortiums relating to that as well, so taking advantage of that. And again, the goods or services which are economically procurable only from one source, the one source issue. You got to be careful with that because sometimes that can be defined a little differently. So other than that, contracts also for perishable foods and beverages. You also have the emergency purchase in case, something of urgent comes in. You need at least three-fourths of the board to declare it an emergency, and you can bypass the competitive bidding process for that as well. The other thing I want,
We can ask questions, sure. just understanding the time limits.
We're probably going to take less time on B, so if you may want to bleed into some of a lot of time for B.
Sure.
Okay.
Time if you're still trying to keep to your original schedule.
Well, you mentioned emergencies, because I know one time we had, I think it was a gas leak or whatever, and then we had to, the college interceded, and then later we voted on it. But when you were saying that that four people would need to be to approve, and at what point is that? I mean, is that something that needs to be done at the time that we're bringing in a service?
Yeah, well, good question. It would definitely, it depends on how urgent or the emergency is. If you can, if there's time, obviously, to call a special board meeting and or if the situation that causes an emergency is within a period of near or close by the time that the board is already going to be meeting and it can be put on the agenda, that's fine. Again, under the Open Meetings Act, you have, when it comes to an emergency, it's 48 hours or as soon as practicable. So depending on the emergency, if it cannot wait till what I suggest is 48 hours, then you just put it as soon as possible. The other item that comes about is, let's assume it has, something comes up within the next, that has to be addressed within an hour. I mean, what we would suggest then is also maybe the board can be polled in terms of getting, not a vote, but just in terms of getting an indication for authority, because obviously, for example, if something needs to be done and a board cannot wait, the board then can vote afterwards, like under ratification for an emergency purposes. In those situations.
Or okay. Like a safety issue.
Correct.
That needed to be attended
Correct.
To. And I think that's
Correct.
The case that happened.
Okay.
I just wanted to.
Okay. And I would assume then in that case, the college president would talk to the chair and that would, decision would be made at that point. She could communicate with all
Clarify
of you.
Clarify something?
Sure.
Is an RFP the same as a bidding process? Are they different?
Yeah, they're completely different animals.
Yes.
Because okay, that's what I thought.
Low bidding is the public invitation. Anyone can
Got
come
it.
Out.
Right.
And we're stuck with the low bidder who responds to our bid requirements. RFP, RFQ, request for proposals, request for qualifications in your energy savings contracts, another concept. You're asking contractors to give us ideas. It could be a number. It may not be a number. And that's it's in some ways it can help, in some ways it can't.
Less formal as far as.
Less formal. You can negotiate with
right.
the three. Let's say you're doing an RFP for printing services.
Got it.
You can.
Now let me ask you one more question on responsible bidder. Mm-hmm. I'm a good union girl, and there's a responsible bidder language, and yet there's a responsible bidder in all of these too. They're not quite the same, are they?
No. There's bodies of case law on what is responsible or not responsible, and we had two temporary restraining order cases just this past summer on that exact issue.
Mm-hmm.
Two contractors we wanted to knock out, and we did knock it out, and they sued.
Mm-hmm.
We won both cases, but it's time, it's energy, it's
right.
So if you, as Rez said, if you have an opportunity to not have to publicly bid something, it's
mm-hmm.
wise to take advantage of that ability. But a couple examples, or one example, the Naperville project, one of your, that's near and dear to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
For the architect, as Rez said, there's a selection process.
Mm-hmm.
For the construction managers, there is no selection process. You can choose any construction manager you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But staff looked at this and said, you know what? We can use an architectural firm or a construction manager firm that we have experience with,
mm-hmm.
but let's open it up. Let's see, make sure we're getting good pricing. Let's make sure we're giving other vendors a chance to participate. So they went to the formal request for proposal process for your architect and your construction manager. So I think you're getting a good balance of when it makes sense to use a contractor you have experience with, that's an option. But even when you don't have to, the law doesn't require you to do that, they're still doing that, just to make sure that your dollars are being spent wisely and you're getting, you're opening it up to the public, to the other vendors out there.
Okay, I have a question. So when the election commission selected an attorney and a lobbyist, they went through an RFP process, is that
right.
what they did? And the Forest Preserve, I think.
Yep, we submitted one of those for the election process, so yes.
Okay.
And they can interview, and they can choose, and they can make price and qualifications. It's a lot of discretion, which makes sense. You don't want to hire your attorney because I'll offer you $50 an hour rate, and you're stuck with me.
Nancy, you had a question.
Just responsible bidder also. I'm just mulling this in my mind because responsible bidder always to me was like responsible bid, and there's times we've rejected bids because they didn't meet the standards.
You're thinking
responsive.
Yeah. Where
help me with this then.
Responsive means your bid has to be signed, your bid has to have a bond, you have to give me three references, you have to give me your bank records, whatever you tell them, it's you need to be a responsive bid. If they don't submit the bid bond and you told them they need to, that's not responsive.
So you don't even consider them at all? You don't consider that bid because they didn't complete it.
You can waive, here's where it gets tricky. You can waive certain requirements if it doesn't give an economic advantage to the bidder, and,
mm-hmm.
and there happens all the time. They
mm-hmm.
didn't sign the Drug-Free Work Act certification. No economic advantage to that one way or another. That's something you can waive. You don't have to waive it, but you can waive it. So it gets, again, every topic that we're talking about on its face seems simple, but there's twists and turns that unless, like mm-hmm. Rez and I have litigated these over and over and over, do you realize that the subtleties and you know, the contractors, these are big contracts, so they'll sue over it regularly and so, try to play games with it.
And I would add to just be careful, too, when you're waiving some of these items, because then if you waive for one, the others start coming in and say, well, you can waive that for them. How about waiving this one for me? And that, so you got to be careful, as what Ken said, in terms of
okay, so there's responsive. Economic.
Responsible means
responsible
you're effectively
bidders.
You're qualified to do the job. You don't have anything bad on your record. That's instead of you don't have to be a five-star contractor. It's kind of a low bar. You have
but
to pass
we are
the low
evaluating.
Bar.
Everyone who comes in, we evaluate. Is it your job to do that?
Oh,
yeah. Right. Thank you for being here. Yeah, that we are measuring each person, each company, as to whether they are responsible according to what we consider.
Yeah, they're looking at your direct history with the contractor. Have they been late? Have they had punch list problems? Have they had warranty problems? Have we been involved in litigation? And then you're going beyond that to the next level of the references and experiences with your architects and your construction managers. What do you know about this roofing contractor?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the world. And the farther away you get from your direct experience, the more gray and difficult it becomes to disqualify a bidder as non-responsible.
Okay, thank you.
So from what you discussed, would it be fair to say that if we were then to extend what we want to accept bids for, make it a bit... there's been discussion on the board to have bids for other things that aren't necessarily required by law. Would it be fair to say that invites more problems and issues for the college than
certainly more risk of getting a bad contractor and okay. not getting, which increases the cost. One lawsuit
right.
involving a bidding or a worse, more often is the construction, the defect case. So yeah. if you voluntarily decide to bid something, you're tying your hands in a sense, because you're subjecting yourself to a mandatory process where I'm going to accept a low bidder and try to hope that I don't get a bad low bidder.
And I would add, usually the exceptions, if there's some subjectivity that, and usually there is with some of these exceptions, there's some subjectivity. It is hard to measure that in a competitive bid process, because then, and that's what you do, when you put a piece of paper out there and you're gonna make it a competitive bid, your requirements and criteria have to be on that document, and that's what you're supposed to be using and basing your decision when you make an award, or in this case, your purchasing department, when they make the recommendation for the board. So you have a little more flexibility with an RFP process, for example, to make that determination, whereas you wouldn't have that much flexibility with a competitive bid.
Okay.
So then sure. The RFP process doesn't present the same type of risk that the bidding process.
No, because if you're not just using, you're not telling the world, if you're the low price, we're going to take you, we have to take you. You're giving yourself, as Rhett said, flexibility to really take into account their qualifications that are subjective or just harder to really put your finger on. Is this a between two contractors? You can take the better of two. One company is good, the other company is very good, and you want to take the very good company, and you have that discretion to do that.
Just to let you know where we are time-wise,
okay.
There's about 15 minutes left allocated for also talking about conflict of interest.
Okay. Should we jump into the B then, unless
sure.
any other bidding questions?
Or just
and the other thing, if I may add, I'm sorry, is I think someone asked, and I forgot who. There's also, besides, one of the other issues with competitive bidding is there is the allocation of time that is put into preparing a bid spec, as well as reviewing it and putting the advertisement out there, besides the cost of litigation. So I know there's most public bodies look at that as well in terms of how much time or how much staff time we're putting in and reviewing this and preparing these bids back. So mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. I'll take one more question.
Well, I was just wondering, because you're a representative from the college, you do this, you're here tonight. Is there anything that you'd want to add that we should know about?
Well, maybe one item.
This is Gene Sawansky, who's the purchasing manager for the college. Gene has prior experience at UIC and also Chicago Public Schools, so he's worked in the public sector before as well as the private sector. What I asked Gene to do is to put together what the impact may be if we were to extend, you know, the definition of what had to be bid versus RFP'd. So he has an analysis up here that I'd like him to walk through.
Okay, Sam. What I want to do just quickly is compare a change concept here between what we're currently doing and what it would cost if we were to move to bidding almost everything. And when I look at almost everything, I looked at the category of vendors that we spent over a full 12-month period. How much, if they we spent with them over $25,000, even though no one purchase was $25,000, if we were to say we would bid that whole company as we would bid single events, what would it mean as far as workload and cost? So right now, looking back at a 12-month period, we did 59 bids that came before the Board of Trustees. If we were to look at all of the potential bids we could put out there when we take out the exceptions and the other negotiated type RFPs that we do, we would bring that number up to about 377 in a 12-month period. And then when you start to assess, what does that mean as far as difference in resources needed? It takes a buyer about 19 hours total to do all of the facets of a bid. And that's from the conception all the way through award, evaluation, and Board of Trustee report. So it's 19 hours no matter how, which type of bid you do. If we're looking at the number of buyers we have two buyers right now on staff full-time, one an experienced buyer and one person who's coming along, a new buyer, relatively a year or so. We would have to move up to a total of seven buyers who are experienced buyers to handle that workload of 377 bids in a 12-month period. Cost-wise, if we take a cost of a buyer and benefits, it's roughly $180,000 for the two buyers that we have, which is inclusive of the benefits. They're not making $90,000 apiece, don't? And if we then escalated that just straight line for seven, we would be looking at almost $500,000 for buyer cost alone. Bid advertising costs have moved from about $4,500 to about $20,000 a year for just advertising cost of the bidding process. And this is, again, looking at the same 257 vendors today that we deal with. If we were to just say which of those will we go out for and take a bid process to resolve. So it's a quick comparison, give you some idea of what's involved. Any questions on that?
Thank you.
Questions? That's a wonderful illustration. Thank you so much for that. Okay. Did we have any follow-up on either the illustration we had or the information that we were just provided?
Can I get a copy of the overhead?
I think that's, yeah, we could do that. Is there a way we can get a copy distributed or emailed?
Of that slide?
Yes, to the trustees. Thank you. Thank you. We'll move on to conflict of interest.
Thank you for all that.
Yes.
Topic B. We're just going to focus on one of the small areas. The question has come up of your role of foundation board members who also have contracts with the college. I think that's the question that we had heard wanted to be addressed. So. To start out, you have to understand the nature of the foundation because it's easy to blur, and many colleges believe that their foundation is just a department of the college because and for good reason to have that perception, but it's not a correct perception. Your foundation is a separate not-for-profit legal entity that selects its own board, that enters into its own contracts, and it is... in many cases, it's from a legal entity perspective, it's no different than the Red Cross, the Boy Scouts of America, the Girl Scouts. It's a separate legal body. Now, obviously, there's interaction with the college and there's a memorandum of understanding between the college and the foundation that lays out, okay, foundation, we are going to contribute college resources and staff and facilities and funds, and you are going to... raise funds, accept donations, and many donors, believe it or not, are very comfortable with donating to the foundation rather than the college directly. they fear, whether it's real or not, that if they give to the college, donate money to the college directly, it's going to go to things they don't want that money to be used for. It's going to go into the general fund, going for salaries or benefits, or rather than things that the donors put value in the foundation funds, those funds are used for scholarships, needy scholarships. That's what the foundation uses all of the efforts. And those of you who've been liaisons know and see that the real impact that the scholarships have on the students who go to the college. So there's definitely a symbiotic relationship, but it is a separate legal entity. And that's important to understand, because when you get into the questions of, well, should we put restrictions on foundation board members? Because good question. Can foundation board members be on the foundation board if they have a contract with the college? I think that's what the question was. The answer is yes, because it's not an illegal conflict of interest. It's not an unethical conflict of interest, because your interests, those board members serve the interests of the foundation. That's where their decision-making is. And those foundation board members are not elected officials or any decision-making bodies at the college. So that's a distinction. It's common throughout the state to find this arrangement where foundation board members typically come from the community, they'll come from retired trustees, they'll come from other active legislators, they'll come from companies doing business with the college because they want to give back in resources and time and talent. So it's nothing wrong with that relationship. So the easy answer is that it's not an improper factor to have. But the most important point is there is a separation between the foundation board and the college. In the past, this college used to have a veto power over foundation members. And in fact, foundation members would only be on that if the college board of trustees approved it. And that type of control over the foundation, legal control, was viewed by your auditors as improper. And in the late 90s, there's a big movement to separate that, to separate the appointing powers from the community college and the foundation board, so that now the foundation board independently decides who's going to be on the board. Obviously, the college suggests who might be good community members, et cetera, to be on the foundation board, but the foundation board makes its own decision. So that's kind of from the legal perspective.
Now, you know I'm ready for this, don't you? Ken's got his eyes right on me. I'm the new liaison to the foundation, and I spent the summer reading through tons of materials that Kathy gave me, and they were wonderfully informative. And when I looked at the list of members of the foundation board, and there were 19 of them, wonderful citizens, but I was struck immediately that 7 of the 19 were vendors of the college. I thought, oh, here in Illinois especially, even the appearance of pay-to-play or conflict of interest is dangerous. But I didn't stop there. I didn't stop with just those feelings, because I'm just new, you know, to all of this. So I did homework. I did a lot of research. I called other community colleges in the area. And I even called David Bass, who's the Association of Governing Boards Director of Research, Foundation Research. And I told him about the situation. I said, I'm just feeling so uncomfortable with it. And he said, it's not uncommon, although it is uncommon in this state. We were just at an ICCTA meeting not too long ago, and Nancy Kim and I did hear from other foundation, or other trustees, who we talked about foundation issues. Only 2 or 3, I believe, if I'm correct, of the trustees who were around that table, not every community college was represented, obviously, but only 2 or 3 had vendors serving on their foundation board of directors. And this is what David Bass said to me, and it finally made it okay for me. I said, okay, this is fine with me. Many of the colleges did tell me, though, that they sought donations from their vendors. They had events at the vendors' homes. And in that respect, it's symbiotic. But the definition of symbiotic is one feeds the other, so it's sticky. So in any case, what David Bass said to me, and I made it very clear, Aaron and I talked about it at length. We met with Bob and Kathy, and that's probably why an RFP is going out now for the Naperville Center. And I'm really happy that it is. It makes me feel totally better about it. David Bass said, You need to be able to document and defend any contract that goes to someone who serves as a vendor to the college and also a member of the associate or the foundation board of directors. If you can defend it and document why the contract went to that individual and that it was competitive, then you're okay. You can defend it, you can hold your head up high, you're good. And I think that's important, and I know Bob agreed, and Aaron did as well. Everyone around the table said it's a change from what we've been doing. But I don't think it's, and I was glad to hear that it's sort of a midway point between the bidding process and just picking the one you like best. And I'm saying that lighthearted way because.
I never weighed in on that.
Pardon?
Never weighed in on that.
Oh, you were just at the table with us, though, because you were there at the meeting. Well, you might not have. You might not have, Bob. But
that's totally different than what you just said. You just said I was in with agreement with that, and I didn't.
Well, I didn't hear you say that you wouldn't do it.
I didn't say that I did. I didn't go either way. I just sat there.
Okay, that's fine. I'm perfectly fine with that. But what happened was that an RFP went out, so I have to assume that at some point you saw there was some validity to what I was saying.
No, it was just an easy way to satisfy an interest that you had.
Well, I think it's pretty serious. Any appearance of a conflict of interest would be totally damaging to our foundation.
I think that's for these guys to go ahead and observe. But the point is the RFP went out for Naperville simply as a means by which to satisfy an interest that you had.
Well, I don't think it's just me. And I would like to ask the members of the board if they feel the same way.
Nobody else communicated that to me.
Well, I'm the only liaison right now. And I know Kim felt strongly about it. Well, she was the liaison as well. She and I talked about it. And I think when you've got vendors serving as foundation board members, they're very generous to the college, no question about it, and it's so appreciated. But I think we have to be careful of the appearance of what it might look like. And that's why I came back and I talked with Aaron and we met. And I was very grateful to David Bales from the Association of Governing Boards for his insight. And for the trustees that I talked to from several of the community colleges in this area for their experiences as well. Because once again, first time as a liaison to the foundation, and I certainly can appreciate it. It's a separate organization. It has its own organization, its own power structure, bylaws, et cetera. It's got an executive director. But it is an interesting relationship because we fund a good deal of the staff. All the staff is funded by the college. And in fact, in some of the community colleges, trustees serve as the chair of the foundation. Right. I mean,
That's one of the old ways that the auditors encourage you to get rid of, and I don't think you guys were ever
maybe
that
that's
deep
not
in
going
that.
To be in the future.
No, that's just the opposite the direction. The independence, mm-hmm. And I think that's a great description that you heard. I think that's a good rule to apply to all the contracts you approve. Mm-hmm. I mean, because
absolutely
in many ways the foundation, because it's a public information who's on the board.
Right.
It's in the colleges that have more of the private contracts that aren't so public that would be more of a concern. So that's a good rule of thumb.
I mean, to justify
any contract you approve, you have to be comfortable with that it's been awarded based on merit and not some other factor.
The RFPs that might go out in the future for other services, it wouldn't be a problem for me. I like to feel that we're getting the best value for the dollars that are provided to us by taxpayers, and I think you all agree with that.
And my experience with the college staff is that the RFP is the norm rather than the exception.
That's good to hear.
And I think if there's any follow-up questions at this time, I apologize, but we are running way over. Both attorneys are available for questions, follow-ups. They might even be here after we adjourn, but we are going to move on to the next topic. Thank you very much for all the information and the work I know that went into this even before today. We're going to move on to the fund balance, which is the last issue of the evening.
So good evening. Based on some conversations, we understand that there's some talk about the use of fund balance and how big a fund balance should be or minimum or whatever. So we put together some information here tonight to share with you that would be based upon the 2013 filings that each of the community college district has to do with the ICCB by October 15th. in the absence of us having access to that, we got the information directly for the, from the school, so we're confident in the information that we're going to share with you here tonight. So if I could focus your attention to the bottom of the page, really is probably the easier way to see this. The range of fund balance would go from the highest at Oakton for 2013 at 140.7% of total operating funds, as we define it, as the general fund, working cash, and auxiliary funds, as a percent of total operating revenues. So the highest of that among the community college districts of the 37 that reported was Oakton, and the lowest was City Colleges of Chicago at 27.2. I think the more appropriate comparison is really our measure versus the collar counties. So these would be mostly, that would be all the suburban county, Chicago County districts. And for 13, you could see we're almost on top of one another, 81.9% for COD versus 80.6. Here of the 12 community colleges, really north of I-80, of those 12, we come in fifth at 81.9 of our 2013 definition.
That's with no set-aside reserves, right? Got it.
That's correct. Here is a listing of all of the community colleges for 2013, and again, we're ranked 13th. And as you can see, Heartland and Shawnee did not provide information as the time we put this together. So the $143 million total fund balance, you have approved the restriction of that for $52,250,000. $22 million going for potential SERS funding being passed back to the college. We've set aside $8 million for our IT strategic plan, $16 million for our funded depreciation account to protect the investments that we've made here on the campus in the last 4.5 years, and then set aside for the 25% of CDB requires for providing funding to us at $6,250,000. So of that amount, the total fund balance of $143 million, 36.5% of it is restricted for the fund purposes we just went through. Almost 64% is unrestricted. And when you take out the restricted, the total unrestricted fund balance as a percent of total operating revenues, which is our definition, is 51.3%. As you can see, the board policy has us maintaining an unrestricted fund balance in those three funds of no less than 50% of the total general operating revenues. The board has approved those two institutional priority or those institutional priorities as part of the budget document in each of the past 2 years, as well as to maintain the AAA ratings that we have with Standard & Poor's and Moody's. Again, here's the restriction. So the general rule of thumb for a reserve for a funded depreciation account is somewhere between 7.5% and 12% of the total property, plant, and equipment. So at the end of fiscal year 13, the value of the college's fixed assets, excluding land, is $548 million. And given that rule of thumb, we would expect the college to have a reserve in the funded depreciation account of somewhere between $41 and about $66 million. Again, today we're at $16 million. And we have expended, I shouldn't say that, between the renovation of Naperville and the Homeland Security Phase 2, we will have expended all of the bond proceeds that were available to us from the 2010 referendum. So today, beyond those projects, there is no fund or no mechanism to do future construction projects here on campus. So here we wanted to just share with you, and you have seen some of these slides before when we've talked to the rating agencies. You can see that the College of DuPage has increased its enrollment from the fall 12 to 13 by 7.6%, where most of our peer group, all of our peer group, has essentially been down or flat. Our tuition and fee revenue has been driven by both enrollment growth as well as the periodic increases in tuition and fees. And so to date, we have not seen any hindrance of our enrollment based on those tuition and fee increases. So since 2008, the college has achieved just under a 7% growth in enrollment as measured by credit hours. And so again, our fall 13 headcount is 7.6% above where it was in 12. You can see a little spike in the 2010 bar based on new program offerings at that time. And despite all the building that we've done here on campus, we're the largest provider of online courses of any community college in the state. So we're taking advantage of our physical as well as our technological assets to deliver education to our students. So here from 2009 to 13, we've achieved a credit hour growth of 3.3% based on our 10th day enrollment. Well above that same time period, the state average has actually declined 8.6%. And so we've just carved out some of what those decreases have been. So Harper down 7.1% over that same time. Triton taking a significant hit at 29% down. So here's our current tuition and fee breakdown at $140 per credit hour. As you can see, the compounded growth rate over the last 6 years since 2009 has been 5.25%. And if you look at it just from FY13 as the base, it's been 2.77%. Not a significant increase in growth, and especially based on where inflation has been. So if we were to just continue to increase our base tuition by $4 per year over the next 10 years, we would end up at $180 a credit hour in 2024. Okay. The total tuition at that time would be $5,400, still a very significant bargain for someone to get education versus where they could go elsewhere. And again, the compounded growth rate over that 10-year period is about 2.5%. So we wanted to begin to share with you some of what's framing next year's budget issues. So as you can see from the previous chart here, one of the line items, the debt service fee of $10 per credit hour, that helps pay our alternate revenue bonds. So those are bonds that are based on tuition revenues, not directly attributable to our general obligation. So the amount of money coming in from tuition to fund the alternate revenue bonds, we are currently underwater by about $3.5 million per year. And so as we begin to think about the budget process for next year, if we do nothing, the scheduled salary increases are $4.4 million. We expect our fringe benefit cost to increase a little more than $3 million. The alternate revenue bond shortfall from the previous page for 15 is $3.3 million. So our incremental cost for us doing nothing, not adding one employee, not one new program, is $10.7 million. The tuition increase of $4 would generate a little more than $2 million to offset that 10. And what we had approved as our property tax levy will bring in about $1.4 million. So we are still short $7 million that we will have to look for as we begin to develop the 2015 budget. And as an aside, we just got word yesterday, so the college has Build America bonds. Those are taxable bonds. So they were implemented or developed really to bring in new investors to the municipal market. There are investors that like taxable debt, but what the IRS does is give us a credit back to make the taxable rate equivalent of the tax-exempt rate. So for us, we're bringing in new investors at theoretically the same cost as if we issued another tax-exempt bond.
The interest rate is higher on the Build America bonds. Than the muni bonds.
Right. The credit that we would get back from the IRS, we would have expected about $552,000 for that. Based on sequestration and other budget challenges in Washington, they are shorting us 7%, so we will not get $40,000 approximately that we would have expected from the federal government to make that taxable yield equivalent to the tax-exempt rate. So that goes to why we don't budget to a specific dollar amount. You need to have some flexibility. That's why we don't necessarily, we're unapologetic, if you will, that we want to build fund balance so we can address these things that you can't anticipate. While it's a small dollar amount, it's systematic of things that we have to consider as we begin to develop the budget or look at the creation of fund balance. So there are other things that we think should be considered by the board for restrictions as we look at the fund balance. And the great thing is that we have worked together to build a fund balance to allow us to have flexibility to consider these types of things. So for future construction, if we were to think about what might be next, we thought maybe a $20 million reserve to begin to think about a classroom space on the west side of campus might be appropriate. We still have retiree health care that our actuarial study a year ago, it's a year or two ago now, year
2 years ago,
two, was valued at $14 million. So that's another way that we would be able to fund, making sure that we have adequate reserves to address those liabilities. And I want to go back to some of what the rating agencies have said, and it's important that we all understand how important it is to them for us to have adequate reserves. So when we issued the bonds in April of 2013, these are comments that were made by both Moody's and Standard & Poor's in our rating report. So they specifically mentioned the sound financial operations of the college supported by healthy and growing reserves. The strong financial reserve position that is bolstered by alternate liquidity. So the fact that we have a working cash fund that provided other liquidity plus the reserves was something that helped us maintain the AAA rating. The financial position they expected to continue over the near or midterm, aided by prudent fiscal management and healthy reserves. And that's all Lynn's doing there. The extremely strong financial position paired with good financial management practices and procedures. So we're getting objective affirmation of what we're doing here is being valued by the rating agencies and, again, by our bond investors because of the strong demand for our bonds. And so, again, their comment is that it reflects their anticipation that with the help of financial management practices, the college will maintain its strong financial operations and reserves despite recent declines in property tax revenue and state funding. So, again, the creation of these reserves is helping us meet the environmental challenges that we face by having limited access to increased property taxes, as well as not having a good financial partner in the state of Illinois. So this is not easy. I don't want the board to think that it is. So if you look at just what has happened in the third quarter of 2013, there have been 235 rating changes, of which 182 were downgrades. 77% of all rating actions in the third quarter of this year were downgrades. 40% of all those downgrades, the 182, were in three states, California, Illinois, and Michigan. And the par value of the bonds that were downgraded was almost $31 billion, which was 57% of the total par value of debt that was downgraded in that quarter. And so when you think about Detroit, you understand Michigan, California with some of the bankruptcies of Stockton, San Jose and others, you understand that. And then with some of the challenges in the city of Chicago and others, you understand that. So there have been the high-profile downgrades. The city of Chicago was downgraded to an A3 with a negative outlook. A negative outlook suggests that there's a future downgrade coming, so they're not done looking at the city of Chicago. That covers $8.2 billion of debt. The Chicago Board of Education rated the same, another negative outlook with a little more than $6 billion in debt. The University of Illinois is still a AA rated, but at the lowest AA rating level, a negative outlook, and they have $1.6 billion of debt outstanding. In addition to the University of Illinois, there were six other higher ed credits in the state of Illinois downgraded in the third quarter. And the most common reason cited in all of this is the large unfunded pension liabilities, large debt burden that they've taken on and operating budget deficits. That's not something that this board sees when they look at our financial statements. So we have addressed our potential funding of pension liabilities in the future. We are very low in terms of our debt burden, and we don't, by practice, look to have operating deficits. So with that as an overview, I know we're limited on time. Lynn and I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Yeah.
I have three questions. I think they're all quick. One is, I think I brought this up at the last meeting, since enrollment was higher than expected, we'll have excess tuition revenue. How much do we anticipate? We don't know that until after the 10th day enrollment, right?
Based on the fall, I think we're up about $3 million.
Okay,
right now.
So it's not.
We're waiting to see what happens with the spring now.
Okay. And then I just had, do you know how long we've had the AAA rating from the bond agencies? I mean.
I don't. And from my perspective, to a certain extent, I don't care. I care about the fact that we've been able to protect it in this environment.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then my last question is, with the legislation that was passed, there was no pension shift in it. We probably have to wait a while to see if they're going to do something else, but how long would we wait before we decided we don't need to keep that $22 million reserved for the pension shift?
Yeah, I think it's too early right now to say that it would be prudent for us to come to say we ought to reallocate that money. You know, you've heard the same things we have, that there's likely challenges to what was passed. Whether it's constitutional or not, that may wind its way through the courts over the next several years. But for right now, we think keeping it there to address that, if in the event that it does become unconstitutional, it has to fall back to us because they have no other source, right? And it's quite stunning, quite frankly, that the legislation didn't put it back on us now. It's quite a surprise. So I think for now, the most prudent thing would be to continue to keep that reserve.
All right, but at some point we might.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But you got the other boxes. You just pointed two other boxes up there, and the one box would be significantly underfunded in terms of the maintenance of the physical plant.
Correct.
So that $22 million could find a home in multiple places.
Right. We're $25 million short right now in the funded depreciation reserve based on the most conservative view of that, 7.5%. So that would almost, if we were to reallocate it, we would likely suggest that it be moved to the funded depreciation.
I would just say, though, too, with the CSRS, I mean, I know they came up with this fix, but I think if you look at the numbers and the basis for what they did, they really didn't do much. And it's really hard, as financial people look at this, to understand how they're going to get that much savings. So, you know, our state has done a lot of things with smoke and mirrors, the little band-aids, and they talk like this is really for the long term, but it's really hard to believe what they did is really going to fix the pension problem. So I'd really caution you on that, that, you know, 10 years down the road, this is going to go on, and people are going to see that this really isn't going to fix it.
Right. One from Diane, and then I know Kathy has several questions that I want to move on to.
Earlier in the presentation, you mentioned the general rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. Reserve should be 7 to 12% of the value of COD, excluding land. Where'd that general rule of thumb come from? That's kind of an interesting number.
Mm-hmm. There's a number of places. Funded depreciation is really a concept that hospitals use because they were able to gain additional Medicare reimbursement for having that on their balance sheet. So in the healthcare setting, it's been that 7.5%. I've looked everywhere for trying to find, higher ed institutions in particular, and quite frankly, there aren't many that are as well prepared or as flexible as we are to be able to even have such a reserve. So in the absence of having something more formal, that's the most current or most relevant.
That's interesting. Is there any other way to pay off those alternate revenue bonds? Can you only pay them off with tuition and fees?
That's the primary source of repayment is tuition and fees, and then to the extent that there's a shortfall, it goes on to the general obligation
levy. It can't be paid from other funds.
Right. So I would, if I could, tomorrow I'd get rid of the Build America bonds. I don't like them. If I could get rid of the alternate revenue bonds, I'd get rid of them. but it's not economically feasible to do so right now. It would cost us more money than it would be.
And was the enrollment increase headcount, at one point it was 9-something, I believe, and maybe I'm getting confused with some other number. I hear 7.6 now. Is that what we ended up with at the end, 7.6 headcount increase?
That's correct.
No?
No.
That was the 10th day, correct, yeah.
10th day, and it was 9.4% on the headcount, 7.6 on the FTE.
Right.
Oh, FTE is 7.6. Thank you. That's it. Sure.
Yeah, I know what it is. We have it. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Tom, I just distributed this information to everybody here so that they could share the mandatory budget reserve policy from our board book. And, you know, maybe I have an old copy of this, but I'm just trying to reconcile the benchmarks that we see as, you know, I see as a board member with the policy. So I'm just wondering, is this a current policy?
Well, so this is dated March of 2009.
Yeah.
This is prior to myself and Lynn being here. And so I was specific in my comment that said that the institutional priorities in the budget book that speak to total operating revenues. That's why we've been that's how we've been managing it. I can tell you ever since I've been on this campus, all of the conversation has been around revenues, not expenditures.
I understand
so I
that.
I can't speak to this policy.
I understand that, but I'm just trying to understand as a board member what was decided as board policy. And from is this board policy what we're looking at here?
Is that the current one, Marianne? Okay, so that's the current policy.
So the board policy, when they talk about reserves, they talk about 50% of basically the general fund from the previous year, which in our case is $80 million, right? I did that calculation. But in your case, you look at, instead of the expenses, you look at the revenue, which is different, correct?
That's correct, and so we also include the auxiliary fund and the working cash fund.
Yeah, I did that. Yeah, I did that in my calculation. I see that later on that was incorporated in 2011. I understand that. Thank you. But I just want to make sure that everybody here knows that when we are getting financial presentations, they're talking about and this is important to know because like right now there's a $12 million difference between what is our board policy and what we're hearing. As a percentage of revenue, it does make a difference, especially if we're making decisions about, you know, millions of dollars. But you know, I mean, there are probably reasons for it. But I think we need to be, you know, we need to know what the reasons are, and we need to understand that this is actually a departure from board policy. Do you know what I'm saying? Does mm-hmm. anybody have any questions about that? You know.
Well, I think one of the reasons why we also hear from Tom to explain some of this is that I don't know if we can just use the conclusory statement that there's just a $12 million difference and we have to be cognizant of that. I mean, and as you said, there's reasons for it.
It's a conceptual. Yes, I'd like to know the reasons. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is there must have been a reason why they decided it was a percentage of expense. I mean, if we're the board and we're asking to see something as a percentage of expense and then we get presented something, a percentage of revenue, and that's not something that we conceptualized and put together as a target. We need to know. We need to know. That's why I brought this up. So anyway, I think that, you know, we do have a deficit of $7 million, right? And part of that includes some of the bonds, some of the the failure to meet our obligations for the alternative minimum bonds.
Is this what you're speaking of, the $7 million?
I'm sorry?
Is this what you're speaking of, that $7 million?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And the alternative revenue bond shortfall. Now, we just had a tax abatement, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was $19 a head of every resident in DuPage County, something like that. And the source of that tax abatement was not the alternative revenue bonds. It was, what was the source of that abatement?
So remember, when the bonds are filed, so when we issue the bonds, even though they're funded, the primary source that goes out in the OS statement, we tell the bondholders that these will be funded from the revenue the college generates. But there is a taxes, are filed with the clerks of each. So if we don't do anything, if we don't abate it, that tax would be levied onto the taxpayer. So that's what you abated. If we didn't do that, we would have had funding from the taxpayers to pay for these bonds. And we didn't want to do that.
You didn't want the taxpayers to pay for the shortfall of the revenue bond?
Right.
Okay, so you pushed that onto the basically either the fund balance or somewhere else in the budget?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn. Okay. So we're looking at this reserve that we have, and then we also look at this percentage, which has molded into something that, it's actually a percentage of revenue when we as board policy ask for percentage of expense. So when you look at percentage of expense, that includes in it O&M, it includes other elements. And my question is there duplication? Is there duplication in putting money aside for a reserve and putting aside a percentage of revenue or expense or, however you defined it? Is there a duplication in that?
I don't understand the question. A duplication where?
I'm sorry. Let me back up and explain it. Okay. So we have, let's just for illustrative purpose, because everyone thinks about, I'm going to put away 6 months' worth of expenses, okay? So the College of DuPage says, we're going to put away 6 months' worth of expenses. And that's basically what we've done. But in that expense is O&M. So, and then we turn around and we say, we're going to put some money in our savings account for O&M. So that's our reserve. So we have a reserve here, and then we have a percentage of our income that we're putting away for a rainy day for O&M. So we have double counting. Question, is that right?
No.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
Why is that?
So I would say
it's O&M.
That if you look at your general
maintenance.
If you look at your general operating expenses, what it costs to operate this facility, this
I
college,
have that page too.
That's what that first reserve is for. That's what your operating expenses are.
Right.
The O&M fund, this college just invested well over $500 million in its infrastructure. So now the point is you want to keep that infrastructure in a state of good repair. At some point in time, you're going to have to do a major rehab. And that's what you're trying to do now is put money aside
to pay for
those major repairs later on.
I got it.
So
thank you, Lynn.
So those will be over and above the normal operating.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. All right. So that was my – so anyway, going back, I just would just like to say to my board members, we do have a departure here from what we're being presented and what we've decided as a board. Number one, I think we should think about that. And number two, I really think we should think about our reserves and also how much we're putting aside and whether or not we want to continue to do that or whether or not we want to continue to take like the $7 million worth of budget shortfall and apply it to our quite ample budget surplus. So anyway, that's all. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We are at 9:45. So at this point in time, I really do think we need to wrap it up. Tom and his team are available in the interim. I'm sorry, you guys. Everybody gives me dirty looks when I try to manage time.
I'm not giving you a dirty
But that's part
look.
Of my role, okay? It is 9:45. It is 9:50. I'm calling an end to the meeting. There are people available to answer questions. And that's how it's going to go.
Can I make a suggestion that in the future we try to consider how much time, because part of what I value is us having the chance to ask questions.
I did, Nancy. I work very hard to consider every single person's opinion around this table. I try to consider that as of Friday, everybody wants this to end at 9 o'clock. So I try to consider what everybody comes my
11.
Way with. So the speakers were asked to limit their presentations to 20 minutes. That should build in some times for questions. I am trying to let everybody answer or ask as many questions as possible. These people have been here all day. They are available in between meetings. They are available whenever you'd like to give them a call.
But then we don't get a chance to hear the cross. You know, if Diane asks the question,
I understand.
I answer.
So. I understand, but you know what? The meeting's done.
I just have a quick comment.
Yes.
I appreciate the time that you put into trying to manage the time, and I appreciate what they did. And we probably should look at policies at some point.
Sure.
But deferred maintenance is bad, so we need to support them so we don't have to go into deferred maintenance ever. It's bad. That's my comment.
Okay.
I guess I'll move to...
All right, second.
I wasn't going to say anything tonight, but I have to say this to you. I started a planning committee meeting yesterday with the two of you, the board agenda planning, and you said to me yesterday that it was the disposition of this board to be done by 9 o'clock.
It was, but they didn't.
It was the disposition of this board to be done by 9 o'clock. With that, let's be honest about this stuff and not manipulate. That was the disposition. Yesterday I sent out a memo that said to everybody, 60 minutes for Mike, 20-20-20. They all got it. This chair was doing what this board sentiment was, and then at the end, you want to be disruptive and you want to be angry.
I don't actually, I don't get that.
Diane, wait a minute. I don't get this. You can't have it both ways.
What
if you want to go in one direction, if you want to meet till 11 o'clock tonight, I will sit here till 11 o'clock tonight and we'll respond to this. In the end, you know, when it comes to the amount of money you have in the bank, spend it all. If that's what you think you should do, spend it all. If you don't think you should raise tuition, don't raise it. My job will always be to you to protect the fiscal health of the institution. I will make the recommendations accordingly. You discharge your duties however you see appropriate to do it. You don't want to have a reserve for this, 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 or this, don't. Ask yourself a question. If you grow enrollment, if we continue to grow enrollment, don't be angry with me. Let's just get real about these things. If you want to grow enrollment at this institution to generate revenue, and to be able to spread the influence of this institution, you will eventually run out of classroom space. If you do, you're going to have to build it. Where are you going to get it from? The state? No. The state can't even give you the $20 million it's owed you for how many years now, Marianne? Can't get that. You're going to go out in a referendum? You ready to do that in 2015? You ask the taxpayer again, Kathy? You willing to go out and do that? So how are we
going to build? $143 million. We're not going to ask them anything. And if we unreserve, we have more money than the amount of the bond offering 2 years ago.
Kathy, the point of it is you wouldn't have that option if we didn't do that. That's the point. You wouldn't have that option.
Do not yell at me.
Kathy, you manipulate stuff to the nth degree. The point is you have accommodation and flexibility.
You manipulate. You don't manipulate.
All right, I'm stopping this.
Too much.
I'm going to entertain a motion to adjourn.
So move.
As moved by Secretary O'Donnell, I'm sorry, but my right eye seems to be stronger today. I'm going with Trustee Svoboda. Secretary O'Donnell, can you please call for a voice vote?
Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
We are adjourned.